Albert Einstein once said, "Wisdom is not a product of schooling, but of the lifelong attempt to acquire it." This is the Producers Lounge Podcast, the best podcast online for tips and tricks on producing great film, television, and web content. Welcome back for Season 2, Episode 21, hosted and produced by GreaterAndGrander.com. On this week's episode, we're chatting with Bill Schultz, who has produced animated TV shows including The Simpsons, Ed, Edd n Eddy, and True and the Rainbow Kingdom. We discuss the incredibly interesting side of corporate entertainment, including how filmmakers stand out in the marketplace, intellectual property, and how laws and regulations affect the landscape for producers in film, television, and animated content. Bill Schultz was born in New Jersey and has worked for juggernauts like PBS, Fox, and many others, and is one of the few producers we've talked to about taking an entertainment company public. If you have any questions or suggestions as you listen, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know in the episode comments. Here now is my conversation with Bill Schultz.
You know, the good news is you can edit this. The bad news is you can edit this.
Yes. So. But yeah, thank you so much for jumping on. I was looking over your IMDb and I realized you actually might know a couple friends of mine over at Film Roman.
You know, it's funny because I'm really good with names, or I used to be. Mm-hmm. But I think my hard drive is full. But I left Film Roman in 97.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah. I was there, you know, from 1989 through 1997. I think when I left, we had about 450 people, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we were doing Simpsons, King of the Hill, probably about 10 half-hour series per week, or not, oh, wow. Not per week, but, you know, we had 10 series in production for the year, for the season. So you multiply, and of course, The Simpsons had a quite large crew, King of the Hill, because we did so much of the artwork in-house. So, you know, I think it even got a little bit bigger maybe after that, But I can spend a lot of time doing what I call a kind of Jewish geography. Oh, well, you know this person, or it's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with Kevin Bacon. But were you in the animation business as far as production or producing?
No, I was in live action, and I my background is I graduated USC, and I was like, oh, I want to be an independent producer, and you know that was still when independent films had a budget, and then after the fight. Yeah. And then after the financial crisis, like everything was like, oh, can you make it for like $250,000? I'm like, ooh. So I became really good at that niche.
I just, you know, it's amazing to me, you know, having been in the entertainment business, I moved out to LA after I graduated University of Illinois and just got in the car with my wife, which was my girlfriend at the time, and my Siamese cat, and we got off the freeway, off the 10 freeway or the 101, maybe it was the 101 in Hollywood, and we're like, we're here. You know, I didn't know anybody here, didn't know anything about anything. Had a degree in poli sci, and of course, you know, it's different. There were no computers, so you know, my net. Just getting started in terms of informing, well, what is this industry all about? It was, you know, getting the Hollywood Reporter, getting the Daily Variety, getting the Music Scene. That was a magazine for music because I was songwriting too. And, you know, and I compare that to like what it's like now coming out to, you know, relocate to be in, well, of course, there's an entertainment industry now in New York and, not so much Chicago, but, you know, there are a lot of other places. I just think about how I got from one thing to the next without computers and all.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I want to ask you, okay.
Yeah, you know what I was going to say is we're talking about the podcasts, and podcast is just another platform, right? So when we took Film Roman public in 1995, the big graphic on the front of the prospectus was we were able to use The Simpsons. So we had, you know, Homer and the family right there in the center. And then we had like spokes, or we call that the hub. So with a, you know, with an a piece of IP like The Simpsons, you can do all sorts of other. You can do licensing and merchandising, T-shirts, DVDs, CD-ROMs. Those were, that was actually a thing. You know, but it was like, you know, people were still selling VHS tapes. So you had all, these were the different platforms that you could exploit your IP on. And now you can have a long discussion just by talking about the different digital platforms for the content. So, you know, when I think of how much content is available for people that want to consume content, you know, podcasts, you know, websites, the show itself, streaming, current episodes, you know, it's like, it seems like, how does, you know, it's like, literally, I had this theory about, I wrote an article for Kids Screen Magazine in the, back in the 90s, like, it's going to get to the, be the point where if you create something, it's going to kind of be like, you know, if a pin drops in the forest, does anyone hear it? You know, like just a joke as far as, because there's so much content available.
Yeah.
You know, how can you connect it? You know, you obviously now people can search, but I think that that's the exciting thing now, is the, that the consumer can search for the content they want. And it's more of a myth for a creator to think about creating a hit by driving the content into the waiting arms of the consumer. You know, because everybody's got so much coming at them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's from all angles. Like, you go on Facebook or, you know, Twitter or any of these platforms, and you're just inundated with ads constantly. Like, how does one stand out? You know,
It's hard.
Yeah, and you're lucky that you're more in a, well, Home Plate Entertainment, do you guys actually own the IP, or are you more focusing on production management stuff?
No, I mean, I started Home Plate Entertainment, so I would have like an umbrella organization. I, you know, my last studio was well, it's called Splash now. At the time, it's called Moon Scoop. You know, Mike and Liz and I had a studio for about 12 years. We sold 51% to a French company called Moonscoop. And so there we would, you know, start off with a blank piece of paper, or we would start off with a book that somebody brought us, or, you know, a legacy property, like we did The Bratz, or, you know, Clifford the Big Red Dog. And so anyhow, when I left that partnership in 2010 and started Home Plate Entertainment, it was the idea that, okay, well, any of the things that I do as part of my normal bouquet of services, so it could be project management, it could be distribution, it could be exploitation, it could be development, Home Plate would do that. So for example, I've done some service work. I worked on a show called Guess How Much I Love You. We did the Disney version for the US with the Australian producer, and a couple of other series where it's just service. But then I also created a show called True in the Rainbow Kingdom with friends with you, and Pharrell, and we partnered on that, and we own that IP along with Guru, and have a new show with PBS that we're owners in. So, you know, we co-own, and really whatever makes sense. You know, the business has changed so much. So, you know, really being, I was going to say, you were talking about being an independent producer and what a struggle that was in the, you know, noughts. You know, the only thing worse is being an American independent animation, an American animation independent producer, because unlike all the global competitors where they get subsidies and grants and things like that, you know, Americans just get the market. And it got to be where everybody's looking for a deal. So the networks would take advantage of they'd have the international producers come and pitch them shows that were already pre-financed so they could pay less of a license fee. So it kind of left American producers in a position where, I mean, like you would have never had a Hanna-Barbera because mm-hmm. Hanna-Barbera, you know, based on the creativity and of Joe Barbera and Bill Hanna, you know, but they could go to the network and sell two or three shows a year that the network paid 100% for, and they could own the rights. And so the business model was such that an independent producer could own the library. Now, if you're a creator, I mean, the fact that I own True and the Rainbow Kingdom and a couple of other, it's rare. We made that deal with Netflix in 2015 when they were just getting started. Now the starting position, you go into Netflix and they want to own it, which is, you know, which is fine. They, you know, they'll pay 100%. So, you know, that the migration of the deal structure for producers really is what determines who owns what. And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that because he was the one that led the repeal of what was called the FinCEN, Financial Syndication Interest Rules. Basically said the network couldn't own the studio or the studio couldn't own the network. So by allowing, and I think that was repealed in 92 or 94, but by allowing that to happen, that's when you saw Cartoon Network with Turner, Disney owning ABC, mm-hmm. You know, and Saban bought the Fox Kids Network. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it basically just put another nail in the coffin of the independent producer. Because now, you know, the deep pockets of a Nickelodeon or Viacom, there's no way to compete, or it's very difficult, I should say.
Right, right. And that's very interesting because you mentioned that Netflix, you know, they want to own it. What I've heard, and perhaps the person who told me this was mistaken, but like Netflix does a lot of their stuff through acquisition, and they'll buy basically anything as long as they can pay a low price for it. But in those circumstances, the creator retains the rights. So,
well, you know, the way to look at it, at that, I don't think that that's a great description of the transaction. Mm-hmm. It's a smorgasbord or a tapestry of finance. But if you have a project that in your mind's eye you'd like to produce, there is a total cost of production. Now, to the extent that you're able to pay 100% or 50%, let's say, of the total cost of production, you're in a position where you can retain a lot more ownership for that. But if you're in the position where you need someone else to finance it, then they're going to retain the ownership. So mm-hmm. what used to happen, and like I said, that speaks directly to the financial syndication rule. So mm-hmm. back in the day, the network was happy and they made their money off of selling advertising. So they were happy to pay $250,000 or $300,000 a half hour for a cartoon, a Saturday morning cartoon, and let the studio own the rest of the rights. Mm-hmm. But as the conglomerization happened of all of the producers and networks, they were like, well, we'll pay half of the cost of production and we'll keep the US rights. And you can keep a percentage of the merchandising and maybe international rights. And slowly but surely, they got to the point where they would offer less and less a percentage of the total cost of production and retain more and more of the most valuable rights. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, when networks start out, they love being, you know, Nickelodeon started as an acquisition network. You know, they ran reruns of, you know, whatever cartoon you hadn't seen in 20 years. Right. Very little in-house production, and you know, but they would do anything to just fill up the airtime and have a low cost of acquisition. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, as a network, the networks are successful because they come up with that. Like, imagine Fox broadcasting without The Simpsons, or Comedy Central without South Park, or right. MTV without Beavis and Butthead. Right. Mm-hmm. So those are just a few of the examples. And so what was great about animation is that, you know, we felt that, you know, if a network wants to really become signature and have a proprietary audience, they have to own and control something.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, look, what is it? What network do you have an affinity for because of Seinfeld? I can't answer that.
Yeah, because it was in syndication most of the time I saw it.
Well, it was okay. So that's an example. It was produced for NBC, and so if you back in the day, I mean, this must be 25 years ago, if you said Seinfeld, that was like someone said, "Oh, NBC." So you know that was the anchor, and they. But all they had was a contractual right to broadcast for a certain number of years, Seinfeld, and they didn't own it. So when that contract, and usually they were like 5-year contracts, when that contract expired, they would try to renegotiate, and you know they would get really slammed for, because that's when everybody would say, well, we want to make the money now of what the value is going to be in syndication, as you put it. Right. There was a syndication business then, but basically the network no longer could control it. And eventually now, Columbia, which is the producer of it, or Sony, mm-hmm. Columbia, they've sold it to the highest bidder a number of times. So, you know, maybe they sold it to the company for syndication, then they sold it to Netflix, and now it might be on Amazon. So that's what it means to own and control the library. So it just so happens that, you're testing me, but Fox used to own The Simpsons, 20th mm-hmm. Century Fox, not 21st Century Fox, but 21st Century Fox was sold to Disney.
Yeah.
Disney owns The Simpsons, but FBC is owned and controlled by the Murdochs. And they own a studio Disney didn't keep called Bento Box, which is the studio that produces Bob's Burgers.
Right.
So you have these really crazy splits of who owns what rights, who owns the underlying IP, who owns the right to make new episodes. So what was a fairly straightforward business when I got into it in the late 80s and 90s has now become, a good producer should know how to use Excel, because you're dividing up the rights so many ways to get your financing done.
Right.
So I actually, because I grew up in an analog world when, we still used film before there was any digital, but when we started producing The Simpsons, there was no such thing as an animatic. Mm. The animatics were shot. They were shot on 35mm film on an Oxbury, transferred to, and we just say develop the negative, and then we would go and do something called telecine, which is transferring film to tape, and then that would be the way to play it back with the writers. Nowadays, we did a test for scanning the storyboard in to sync it up with the dialogue, which is basically what an animatic is. Mm-hmm. And Apple actually gave us the computers, and we ran tests for probably 6 months. There was not enough memory, and the speed of the computers wouldn't work, so we couldn't do it.
Wow.
So I lived in the world before there was Excel, before there was Avid, before there was nonlinear editing, before there were DVDs, before there were, QuickTimes or whatever. So I kind of know every little piece of it, and that speaks to the distribution as well.
Right.
So it's crazy how much the entertainment industry has grown, and animation in particular.
Yeah. And I was looking over your IMDb and your Wikipedia, and I have to say that one thing that definitely comes through is your amazing business acumen, because you've been part of companies that have gone public, and you've worked with other companies. You're the only guest I've ever had who started their own restaurant. It was,
wait, I didn't. A restaurant?
No, Wikipedia. Actually,
you know what? I should look at that. Wikipedia. Someone told me that Wikipedia is the first place you should check for information, but not the last.
Ah.
Somebody must have edited, and I haven't looked at my Wikipedia in 10 years, probably. So, does it say on there? Hold on, let me just.
It's something called Uline or WeLine.
I know what it is. No, we well, it, what you're saying is true. I have done a lot of different types of business configurations. We started a business with Comcast, a children's channel for just for video on demand called Kabillion. It's still out there, and it's in about 90 million homes. We made a co-venture deal with a restaurant called U-Wink.
Oh, okay.
And so we supplied content for U-Wink in exchange for being on their computer screens at the restaurant. Interesting thing about that, it was created by a guy named Norman. You can look in insert name later. He was the creator of Atari. He created Atari and Chuck E. Cheese.
Wow. So
but I have taken, you know, Film Roman, we took public, we raised money on, you know, both private and public. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was an incredible experience. We raised $33 million on the NASDAQ. I've sold companies to international companies. I've done really all of it as just though, because I wanted to produce something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get this kind of vision in your head of of the producers, right? Sells 150% of his Broadway play.
Yeah.
But basically the independent producer who's willing to do whatever it takes to make his film. And it's not that untrue. I mean, I remember working with Joe Barbera on the Tom and Jerry movie, and he would tell me, you know, he could tell stories forever. Like, he has great stories. You know, when he pitched the Flintstones and the Jetsons, and you know, he was just a real showman. But he would go in, you know, in the late 80s to pitch ABC, and he would go in and he'd have one pitch based on Casper, one pitch based on Chips, you know, the motorcycle, and then another pitch on dinosaurs. And the network in the pitch would say, well, we don't need any stories about a kid on a dinosaur. And he'd say, oh, did I say a kid? And he'd flip the cell over, it would be a kitten on the dinosaur. And they actually sold one show where they combined all three together. It was like dinosaurs in outer space with a ghost. You know, the business was so, you hear stories about that series Episodes. Have you ever seen that? Not animated.
I think it's a new show, right? It's on FX.
It's a parody. It's a parody of a couple who created some hit show in the UK, you know, which is probably like six episodes, and you know, because they don't produce at the time, and then they come to a big network here, and they just get the complete, you know, run around.
Wow!
I love those. You know, it's an inside show. But anyhow, it's true, and so you know, you have stories of, you know, like John DeLorean, who wanted to get his car made, so he ended up saying yes to doing some sort of a cocaine deal, and then I got busted by the FBI. I've been very lucky to work on really great projects with great talent and people, and so I've developed, I think, a pretty good nose for when something has that special something, so that, you know, I always start off thinking like, how is this going to get made? Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's lots of people who spend their whole career developing projects for 10, 15 years and never get it made. Mm-hmm. You know, I really, as a producer, since I've always been involved in production, the idea of developing something and not seeing it come to fruition was more than I could stand. So, you know, you can, as a producer, you can say, well, my ideal scenario is this, at this budget, with this talent, in this way. And you say, well, we can greenlight this project, but we only have we have less than that. How can you bring the budget down without sacrificing the quality? And then you look for ways, instead of making this, you know, an anthology or something, we'll make it, you know, three sets through the whole thing.
Right.
So, you know, knowing where you can compromise, but it's all starts with that yearning to produce something, to tell that story.
You know, you said something earlier that I really want to ask you, because you have seen, you know, you've seen the rise of CD-ROMs and DVDs and Blu-rays and YouTube, and looking at, you know, people tell filmmakers now all the time, like, oh, you've got YouTube, you've got podcasts, you can do whatever to get your story made and get that out there. But also part of that is, you know, yeah, you can do something on YouTube, but you might do like 6-10 episodes and then get, I don't know, a few hundred views, and then it can't get through the wall of content, the wall of platforms. So if someone's a content creator now, or they want to tell a story, let's say hypothetically a you know, kid show, science education, I don't know where I'm coming up with this example, but let's say they want to do that. What do they do if they want to make something that lasts, that is financially self-sustaining? And like, where do they go? Do they do a proof of concept on YouTube, or do they just try to get into every network they can beg, borrow, and steal to get into?
Yes and yes, in a way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I used to have a inside joke just in my head, mm-hmm. that, you know, these people that would get their friends and family to contribute a couple $100,000 so they could produce their pilot. They mm-hmm. do it without the input of any distributor or broadcaster. And I call those expensive paperweights, because mm-hmm. ultimately the pilot, you know, if it was a tape or a DVD, they just sit on top of someone's desk as a stack of papers, but never be the launching pad to the franchise that they had envisioned. Right. So the thing is that, you know, how do you go from an idea to something that has cultural significance, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of penetrating through the clutter and, you know, being renewed, or whatever trope you want to use for saying a successful piece of content. Mm-hmm. So there is no one way to do it, but I think, you know, the biggest challenge is that how do you communicate your idea to the people that you need to get excited about and say yes to your project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you and I are sitting and having a conversation, maybe I can explain it well, or maybe I can't. Maybe you've got something else on your mind. The chances of me, if you're the guy that needs to say yes to get to the next level, if I'm just trying to explain it, I might really struggle to get you as excited about it as I am when I'm sitting and thinking about it. So mm-hmm. do some artwork. Mm-hmm. So now I can at least show you some pictures and get you excited about the artwork. And then, so then it becomes a sort of cost benefit analysis. How much mm-hmm. can you do, or can you afford to do, or do you need to do to get people as excited about the idea that you really are excited about yourself? So going too far is usually not a good idea, because if it takes that much explanation and detail and all that, for most people, now that wouldn't be true of, like, you know, really established creators who just have a vision. Mm-hmm. But like Danny Antonucci, who created Ed, Edd n Eddy, mm-hmm. you know, he saw the films in his head, and he only needed a budget so that he could hire the people to help him do the actual production. So mm-hmm. every step of the production for him was just a matter of transposing from what the vision he had. So he sold Ed, Edd n Eddy to Cartoon Network, to Linda Sabinsky, pretty much with a one sheet. It started out, I came on board, Danny had faxed Linda through a one sheet that had the three ads on it, and it had said something about Jawbreakers. Mm-hmm. And in the meeting, it was decided, well, instead of doing a pilot, let's just go and do 13. But he's an example of a creator who could write the story, knew what the voices sounded like, knew what the dialogue was like, and had the complete vision. Sometimes you get somebody who is, you know, a writer, and you know, like, take the perfect look at it. You know, if you think of The Simpsons, it was mm-hmm. the marriage of Jim Brooks and Matt Groening, and I guess Sam Simon and the writers, but it was a writer's world and a director in Jim Brooks, and a cartoonist like Matt Groening coming together. Danny Antonucci, like I said, I mean, it's not the same show, but he had the whole thing. So mm-hmm. you know, as a creator, what do you need? Do you need to have a finished 30 seconds of animation to show mm-hmm. what you're doing? So, you know, it really depends on who you are and what you're trying to do. The deck is, you know, it's stacked against, it's a tough business out there because valuable shelf space is dominated by proven creators. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about, you know, do people discover your content or do you foist it on them? Mm-hmm. You know, it's, so there isn't only one way to do it, but I think as a creator, you want to do enough to make sure that anybody that encounters, whether you're pitching it to them or putting it up on YouTube, that encounters your content, that experience is excited enough to make them want more. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so I think you have to be prepared to prove that your idea is good. Mm-hmm. And that usually means collaborating with an artist or an animator or designer or studio or producer and doing something to show that it's, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen, and to take it further where you actually execute it, execution is everything.
Got it. What are some of the tactics and strategies you've done to make a project come alive and jump off the page in order to sell it and get it made?
That's a good question. Well, you know, it used to be when the business was simpler and, you know, the networks, CBS, let's say, was, you know, they had a slate for the upcoming September launch, you could go into Judy Price with a couple of pieces of artwork and just pitch it. And if she liked it, she'd be willing to develop it with you and maybe pay for a Bible and a few mm-hmm. more pieces of artwork. And then based on that, they would decide to order 13 and a half hours. Nothing is so straightforward now. Mm-hmm. So recently, the show that we're doing with an educational channel, we actually produced a really nice pilot. And that made them decide to go ahead to series. Then, like when I did with True in the Rainbow Kingdom, I was very excited about the visual world of it. It was the idea of taking some 2D designs that Friends With You had created, putting it in a world, but transposing that into 3D CGI. Because it was still, mm-hmm. you know, in 2010, we were still in a world where it was either 2D or 3D. Now, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many tools. You can't really describe what something's going to look like by saying it's CGI or it's 2D. I did, you know, five or six pieces of really well-rendered artwork. No CG, but we painted it to look CG, and hired a really great writer who wrote a pilot script, and we did a Bible. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, I was able to get the other partners, and we sold it to a Canadian network, and we sold it to Netflix. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm really a big believer in music and bringing something to life. So, you know, sometimes we're pitching a show now that it centers around a famous musician. And so we wrote a couple of songs and played the songs during the pitch, which gets people excited. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, music is something that really speaks to people creatively, as opposed to just talking and just pitching that way. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you can't, you know, the production cost on music is something that can be achieved, you know, with not much money, you know, keeping it simple, a demo. We had a demo of a song that ended up getting the Hub to pick up the series.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I think you just have, as a producer, I think one of the skills is to figure out what it is that excites you about your project, mm-hmm. and then find a way by hook or by crook to put that into a presentation that can get the gatekeepers to get excited. So mm-hmm. when we sold Bobby's World, mm-hmm. we did a couple of pieces of art to design the character, but we had Howie Mandel in the room.
Ah.
So, you know, Margaret Lesha was running the Fox Kids Network. You know, that's a great pitch. He, you know, breaks into doing the voice. And, mm-hmm. you know, of course he was a celebrity. He had established the brand, but it's a great pitch. So yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably going all over the place here, but you know, I've done a lot of shows, so I've done it a lot of different ways. And I think that my creativity is in coming up with the different ways to cross that Rubicon.
Well, I'm curious, because like you said that you were, when you first moved out here from Chicago, you were still like doing some songwriting and stuff. What was the drive? What was the moment you decided, I want to do this? I want to be a producer.
So I came out to be, I was going to go to law school and I decided not to. I wanted to be a songwriter. It was kind of a Midwestern or a Jewish guilt that kept me repressed as a songwriter. So I came out here with my demo tapes and mm-hmm. started, you know, meeting with publishers, you know, pitching, playing the piano, singing the song. But I wasn't really an artist. I did not want to be an artist. And I also was writing spec screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, believe it or not, we had typewriters, no word processing. So I wrote scripts and tried to get them read. And I also tried to figure out to learn how to produce something. So I got a job as a production assistant on an independent animated feature called Down on Us. It was like a total of $400,000 shot on a soundstage in downtown LA. And the second day of work, the executive producer says, my co-executive producer had a heart attack and we need someone. Does anybody here know how to write payroll checks? And I looked around and I said, I can do it. I hadn't taken a math class since my sophomore year of high school. Because, you know, you got to do what you got to do, right? So he took me off the set and put me in the executive producer seat, you know, being in charge of the whole production with the unit production manager and himself, and basically got to see how this is producing. Okay. So I learned how to produce independent film. And so from there, I ended up getting some other jobs. I was a production estimator at Columbia Pictures Television on Mickey Splane's Mike Hammer, Crazy Like a Fox, TJ Hooker, and Driving Around the Lot, you know, it was called the Burbank Studios then, and keeping track of all the, this is live action then, the production. But still doing my writing. So eventually I realized, okay, if I keep developing my skills as a producer, I can produce my own shows. And so, you know, I got it. I worked on a soap opera, Santa Barbara, at NBC. And that was, 260 episodes a year, right? 261 hour shows a year. Incredible production. And working with New World Entertainment, the guy who was the head of the, it was like John Feldheimer and Jerry Ammett was the exec. The company bought Marvel, and I had done such a great job. Like, it was kind of a turnaround, because it basically, Santa Barbara was was a show that went bankrupt because the creators couldn't tell themselves no. They said, hey, we should do a location in Santa Barbara when it wasn't in the budget. Or we should go to Italy and do remotes. So basically NBC said, look, you either sell the show to someone else or we're going to just shut the show down. And it was starting to be popular. So New World, who were really smart lawyers, came in and took over the ownership of the show. Well, they did the same thing with Marvel, believe it or not. You know, Marvel, who produced Spider-Man and Muppet Babies and My Little Pony and Transformers.
Marvel produced Muppet Babies?
Yes. So, yeah, most people don't know that. So that was Marvel was owned by a company called Cadence Industries, a publisher back in the East, and they owned Marvel Comics and they owned Marvel Animation. Marvel Animation actually came into being. It was a lot of the same people that had run DePatie Freleng. So Lee Gunther, who was the head of production, was, you know, Dave DePatie's editor doing Pink Panther and Frizz Freleng stuff. And then, but anyhow, that became Marvel Animation. They did some, you know, Spider-Man. Stan Lee was there. And we produced Muppet Babies. You know, that, and that was on CBS, and that was, you know, with Jim Henson and Fraggle Rock. But we also, we're producing all of the Hasbro shows, My Little Pony, Transformers, G.I. Joe. But the company basically became so successful, they couldn't manage production. So they basically went bankrupt. They had production spread out over two or three buildings. They were not using any computers. There was no Movie Magic budgeting software. There was no Excel. So I kind of brought all the production know-how that New World had from working on Santa Barbara into the animation world at Marvel. And Margaret liked my work. And so she also gave me the opportunity to become the director of development. We, you know, meet with, I was, you know, I was 25 years old, and I actually sold that. So it's a long way to get to there, but I actually, my first project I ever sold was something called Battle of the Bands. And, I sold that I pitched that as a replacement for a show called, American Bandstand. Do you know American Bandstand?
It was the
Saturday morning show where kids danced, you know, the white kids danced, the much cooler, but the show for sort of Soul was Soul Train. You know, it was very, very bizarre world we lived in back then. You know, where Michael Jackson wasn't on the pop charts. He was on, I think it wasn't, I don't even think they used the name Urban. They might have called it the Black Charts. Literally, yeah, until you can look, I mean, it's an amazing story. Michael Jackson, like some of the greatest music you've ever heard, he was not competing with like Casey Kasem's Top 40 because he was African American and they would not let these. It's very, it's mind blowing that prejudice and could enter at such a level. It was great to grow up with all learning all this and experiencing all this, but I sold Margaret like that, and I was doing the pitching. You know, we were trying to sell, believe it or not, Spider-Man, Spidey Kids, or something, and none of the networks wanted to hear anything about Spider-Man. Stan Lee and I went and pitched versions of Spider-Man, and we actually had to pay for our own. Our own pilot on X-Men. We did it with downtime. So it had the most incredible, the artists who 10 years later became some of the biggest names in the action adventure kids and, you know, did the X-Men, but nobody wanted anything Stan Lee. It was crazy. So anyhow, we did a demo and we went around and tried to sell it, came close, got Yamaha interested, but ultimately it didn't sell. But
I saw this random YouTube video about a Japanese Spider-Man series.
That was made by Toei. And so Stan and I got the rights to that. And one of the things we did was we cut together a little trailer about it. He rode on this enduro motorcycle and it's Toei. It's really cool. But it just wasn't, an interesting story was, that when I was there, the company Cadence, who owned Marvel before New World bought it, had licensed an option to make a movie of Spider-Man to a company called Canon Films. Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, two, I guess, called C picture makers.
Right.
And they had the rights to produce an animated feature. Well, it turns out that James Cameron wanted to make a Spider-Man movie.
That's right.
But these guys had the rights. They had paid $5,000. They had the rights and they couldn't do it. So there was no, you know, so that probably held Spider-Man back for a good 10 years, because then ultimately Sony got the rights to make it the right way, and they made a great film. And that was, you know, there was this whole arc to when Marvel was, you know, the comics were not successful in the 80s.
Right.
You know, as far as they came into their own war in the 90s, and mm-hmm. that's when all that happened.
Well, I'm really curious, because if we could take a step back, going from, you know, Santa Barbara TV show to working and doing the finances on the Muppet Babies and Marvel and what have you, and then making the jump to director of development, I think you've just outlined every line producer's dream to make that jump. And in this Hollywood where everyone gets pigeonholed, how did you do that?
Well, I was really young. Okay, uh-huh. So I think I was about 26 years old, 27 years old,
uh-huh.
and I was a songwriter and a writer, so, uh-huh. and I had worked on film, so really, I approached everything like a producer, so uh-huh. one of the first meetings where Margaret realized, you know, boy, you'd be an asset to me in development, I was called into a meeting where, Cliff Ruby and Alana Lesser, who's you know, Ruby Spears. You've heard of Ruby Spears? It was an anime. Anyhow, they came in. There was a property. I think it was a version of Star Wars. It was one of the early iterations of Star Wars that mm-hmm. they were going to do. CBS was offering them a commitment for 13.5 hours, and they came in and they were interviewing us as a studio. And I saw the dynamic between them, who controlled the rights, and our grade A producer, directors, writers. And I said to Margaret after the meeting, I said, I don't think they want to use our, I think they want to write it and direct it. You know, because I could just see what was going on. And mm-hmm. literally later in the day, they called and said to Margaret, yeah, we don't want to work with Marvel. We want to do the writing and directing ourselves. And she mm-hmm. was like very impressed that I had picked up on that. But I was, you know, I was into film and into everything and how we were going to make something, how we could develop it. I had developed a relationship with writers. So I basically saw myself in that and I kind of manifested it.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years later, I was hired by Phil Roman as a vice president of production and development. Mm-hmm. I was doing everything there. And that was just the beginning of the, you know, explosion in animation in 1989. Garfield, a 90-minute block of Garfield on CBS, and Bobby's World on Fox. And, you know, anyhow, then we did Tom and Jerry, you know, just did a lot of stuff. So I, you know, only worked 22 hours a day, but,
right.
But I've seen lots of people. I've seen lots of people go from, you know, I really do think the cream does rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're willing, you know, it's different now. Obviously the, you know, I say kids, I have, my kids are all millennials, but there was, you know, when they asked, can anybody here write checks? You know, today that would never happen.
Right.
That opportunity, you know, because, you know, probably what I would have done if in the situation where Margaret says, well, you can be director of development, but we're not going to pay you a double salary. You know, today's workers, a lot of people would say, oh, well, then I won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was literally that, hey, let's put on a show, you know, whatever. I was so into the creative and the producing and the business. And that's why the animation was so great, because it was such a cottage industry. And I've always had that enthusiasm for what I was doing. And I always, you know, having seen so many kids go from, you know, starting where I was 20, 23 years old, interns or whatever, and now they're winning Oscars. Well, close. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of the directors that we hired on The Simpsons are some of Disney and Pixar's best directors. So folks like Rich Moore and,
you know. I mean, Mazel Tov, it must feel very proud for you to have that kind of lineage or have that kind of...
I will readily admit the secret to my success is only that I had good taste and I was smart enough to hang around the best talent. Like I knew I could recognize somebody's talent and just get out of the way. And that's in every area. I mean, really, you know, what do they say that at a good studio, 20%, and now I'm talking from a management perspective. Okay. I'm not talking from the perspective of just being on one show, but in a business, 80% of the productivity comes from 20% of the employees. It's kind of like there's your superstars and stuff. And so I've been very lucky to work with some people who are just awesome. But I mean, you know, Matt Groening, you know, and Jim Brooks, you know, and Al Jean and Mike Reese. These are guys, you know, these are people who really just, you know what they're doing. And so, you know, I'm not a, you know, it wasn't about me. It was about putting together the best team.
Right. One last question, because I know we're coming up on the hour. I know what it's like to be around big talent, because I remember actually, like, when you're around really smart people and really good talent, you just know, like, it's just there. I remember one experience, like, I actually went to, I don't know if you heard about this guy named Justin Simien. He's a director. He's not in animation. He's in live action, but he, really brilliant guy. And I went to film school with him, and like meeting him, like, you know, like, oh, he's got the goods. But then as far as figuring out who doesn't and who's all talk, I'm wondering what advice would you give for sniffing out? What are some red flags for people maybe who you don't want to work with or would want to avoid? Or maybe say they have the goods and they just don't.
Well, and it is interesting. It does happen. And occasionally, you know, so I've hired probably 2,000 people in my career. You know, everything from writers, directors, PAs to runners, you know, whatever. And I would say I've been really lucky to hire good people. So for the most part, just about everybody I've worked with, you know, they were awesome, better than I can expect. But there have been a handful where I had to say, oh, this did not work out. I'm gonna. one of the funniest ones was I hired Gary Coleman to play a character on a pilot we were doing for MTV. And after the recording session, he was such an a-hole that everybody's like, "We got to get rid of him." I'm like, "Oh man, but it's Gary Coleman, you know." And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't bringing it, and he was a nasty person. So I had to fire him, and, you know, the network was fine with it because they did not like the way he was. So that's a surprise, right? You're like, Gary Coleman, you know, and whether you have to pay or play. But here's one thing that I've always said, and I think that this, I heard this on somebody's, it wasn't a podcast because I've heard it was a long time ago, a thought leader. And he told a story about how when he was a kid, his father came home from work one day and said, I have to get a new job. I lost my job. And he's like, what happened? And he said, well, my boss wanted me to make up something and lie to our accountants or our attorneys. And I wouldn't do it. And he said, why not? He said, because that it would be a lie. And, you know, I have integrity. I won't lie. And yeah, but you got fired. He said, it's just something I have my integrity. It's part of my personality, that integrity. And he said that integrity is a way of life. It's not a recipe for success. And so people who are trying to do things and be things because they think they'll be successful, but it's not true to who they are, if you can kind of sniff that out, that's a good clue. So I've always tried to, you know, be genuine and authentic before the word authentic was being you know, as popular as it is now. And I think that if you find other people who are passionate, genuine, and authentic, and you know that you're going to have integrity about what you're doing, I think you can avoid some really big black holes. And, you know, it's kind of like, we all know when we meet someone who is a braggart or someone who is lying. You know, we have this sort of internal sense and we say, well, we talk ourselves out of it. But those are pretty simple things. And I do think, you know, one of the other things that I've really tried to prioritize is I didn't want to work with people who were blowing smoke up my, you know what. Uh-huh. And this business, there's a lot of people who do that. It's a very fine line between smoke and mirrors and, you know, convincing someone that you're going to do something versus really being able to do it. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, that's a huge pitfall right there in this business because everybody is a salesman. And so you have to know, well, when am I going to buy into this? You know, so, hey, my cousin has $20 million in a shoebox and his sister wrote a screenplay. You want to make a movie? Now, what are the chances of that being true? You know, it's not, but you want to believe it.
It's a big shoebox, so, too.
Yeah. So the thing is listening to that inner voice and going 98% of the time, that's going to be a zero.
Right.
Maybe. And it is true. And I have had partners. Mike Young was a great salesman. And there were times where he could spin something and make, what is it? A purse out of sow's ears. Is that the phrase?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And so I was much more sort of like, let me see it. Do you have the goods or not? Is there something here? Are you really what you say? Is this real? And then, okay, everything is risky. So I think that's the other thing is like, you have to just have use a little bit of common sense, right. You know? And I think that's in this business, unfortunately, because, you know, I don't want to say miracles don't happen. I mean, yeah. Kelly Clarkson has had a great career and she was discovered on American Idol. Mm-hmm. She can sing. Like it wasn't like a smoke and mirrors thing. It was a wonderful thing that she got discovered through that pipeline. But you know, if the talent is genuine and authentic and people have integrity and passion, that really will give you a pretty good, I think that is a recipe for success. It'll certainly save you from a lot of grief.
And that is Season 2, Episode 21 of the Producers Lounge Podcast. Thank you to my guest, Bill Schultz, for joining us. You can find out more about him by checking out the show notes and visiting our website at greaterandgrander.com. By the way, for those of you who are curious, the creator of Atari, Chuck E. Cheese, and U-Wink was Nolan K. Bushnell. Our intro and outro music today was Sweet Georgia Brown by Lachey Swing. Our episode still image is from The Simpsons, owned by the Walt Disney Company. You can stay up to date by following us on social media at the handle Greater Grander, all one word. Make sure to subscribe wherever fine podcasts are found, and also, if you like what we do, share this podcast with a friend group or community who you think will enjoy it. Join us next week for more cocktails and questions, and until then, keep producing dreams.